So thank you, George, for a wonderful review. And we have time now, and would like to invite Andy back to the podium. And I'd like to open up the two talks for questions, please.
Yeah, Dr. Onyewu, Mayo Clinic, Rochester and Eau Claire, Wisconsin. This is for Andrew. Great lecture. Just like you talked about the other effects, non-renal, of your MRAs, what's your practice or what's the evidence out there about the use of furosemide, for instance, in oliguric ESRD? Is there a role at all for that in those patients? Thanks.
Just to make sure I got the question correctly, the question was, what's my thoughts on using furosemide in non-oliguric dialysis patients?
No, in oliguric ESRD.
In oliguric ESRD.
Right.
In that situation, I definitely think there's better data for using it in the non-oliguric ESRD patient. And there's a study from Jenny Flythe that came out last year which showed that the overall UF volumes on the dialysis days were better tolerated if you were using furosemide on non-dialysis days. I don't know data on using it in the oliguric patient or the anuric patient. My suspicion would be it's not going to work. That we used to always have a sort of a joke in our dialysis unit, which was the patient who does the best on dialysis is the one who probably didn't absolutely need dialysis. So my feeling is that if they've really reached a point where their GFR is essentially zero, your diuretic's not going to give them any benefit. I don't think there's any non-epithelial effects of loop diuretics.
John. Yeah. A quick comment and a question to Andrew. The comment is the subpopulation of dialysis patients that might benefit a lot from spironolactone, and that's the PD population. They have a very high prevalence of hypokalemia, and the risk of hyperkalemic is very low, and there's one study showing that there is a benefit in patients with LVH. And the question is, for the anuric patient, what's the impact of this class of drugs in terms of hyperkalemia since there's no tubular function?
Yeah. So I think both parts of your question I could probably answer together. So I think the anuric patient, we really wouldn't expect too much of a rise in potassium because there's no tubular effect of the drug. And over 90% of the potassium sparing is done at the level of the kidney. And I think that would actually extend to your PD question in that I do think the PD patient will benefit from spironolactone from a cardiovascular standpoint, but I don't think you could expect that putting a PD patient who's chronically hypokalemic on spironolactone is going to correct the chronic hypokalemia because I just don't think, unless they have pretty good reserve residual function, they're not going to get a significant rise in potassium. And that, in turn, just sort of gets to the whole idea of the safety of the drugs. I do think they will be safe. For example, they're much safer in the anuric dialysis patient than they are in the CKD4 patient who still has some renal function. Because the potassium rise should be lower in the anuric patient than in somebody with a GFR of 15 to 25, for example.
Hi, my name is Caroline Gluck. I'm from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Thank you for your talk. Most of my dialysis patients are polyuric with a type 4 RTA. And so my question to you is there any evidence to suggest that aldosterone receptors in the heart and blood vessels and other places in the body might be different such that you could develop a selective inhibitor?
That's a good question. So just to be certain I got it correctly, you said most of your patients are diabetics with type 4 RTAs?
Polyuric.
Polyuric with type 4 RTAs.
Yeah.
So this actually gets to sort of a global philosophical question, which is that if you have a patient who's diabetic with hyperkalemia, and you're presuming, because I'm assuming that they're also, I'm going to make an assumption that they're diabetic, because most of the patients that we see with hyporenal and hypoaldosteronism, sorry? Oh, these are kids.
Jesus,
oh,
Chad.
I'm sorry.
They all have obstructive uropathies.
I missed the first part that you're a pediatric nephrologist. Sorry. okay. Well, let me answer. Let me just say quickly something about that other thing, and then we'll get to your question. I still think that there is a benefit in the quote-unquote hyporenin, hypoaldosterone patient to block aldosterone, because we still presume that those patients have a salt cofactor, and we still presume that they have enough aldosterone production to cause these non-epithelial effects. So the epithelial effects are still there. Are not there when they're hyporenin, hypoaldosterone, which is why they're becoming hyperkalemic. But the non-epithelial effects, I think, are still blockable. If you look at patients, I know I'm going to adult now, but if you look at adult patients with hyporenin and hypoaldosterone who are diabetic, they're dying of the same thing as the non-hyperkalemic patient. So I would still think about blocking them. The question is how to do it safely. And if they can respond to loops, I would give the spironolactone along with the loop. You can use lower doses of spironolactone. So many of the studies using spironolactone have used a 12.5 milligram dose rather than a 25 milligram dose. And I know that one of the sort of pushes of pitiramir, for example, is that one of the things that you'll hear from the people who make this drug is that, well, it will potentiate your use of renin-angiotensin aldosterone system blocking drugs. So could you more safely put your child with a potassium of 5.8 on a renin-angiotensin aldosterone system blocking drug if you knew that you had a potassium binder on board that would be safe as opposed to a potassium KX-late? So I think there's no perfect evidence-based answer to your question, but I still think some of the rationale to blocking aldosterone is there. George may have a better answer to that.
No, I fully agree. I think kids are a different issue, and you know, I think that we have the tools to do a number of things right now. The problem is not having the tools. The problem is the cost and the fact that there's not a lot of evidence to support some of the assertions that we're saying. That's really the issue.
Dr. Bombeck,
yes.
Many of our dialysis patients already will have heart failure before they come to dialysis. My question is, how do you recognize, they are on ACE inhibitors, how do you recognize aldosterone breakthrough in these patients? You know, of course, in patients with CKD before dialysis, aldosterone breakthrough will probably cause worsening renal functions. We could recognize it that way, but how about in dialysis patients?
Well, so the question is, how would you recognize aldosterone breakthrough in a dialysis patient? It's actually a difficult phenomenon to recognize even in the non-dialysis patient. Most of us are not serially checking aldosterone levels. I mean, outside of maybe some really specialty hypertensive clinics that renin profile and aldosterone profile patients and do so on a regular basis to ensure that they're getting adequate drug prescribing, most people are not routinely checking renin and aldo, and if they're doing they're only doing it once. So you have to actually do a cross-sectional evaluation for aldosterone breakthrough. And most of the literature would say that a standard, there's two ways to define it. One would be to take the mean aldosterone level for population, which for men's a little bit higher than women, but it's roughly about 10 nanograms per deciliter for a man and 8 nanograms per deciliter for a woman. The other way to define it, which is more conservative, is just to say an aldosterone that's above the upper limit of normal. And all of these patients with CKD and ESRD are already doing the equivalent of a saline suppression test because they're all eating, on average, 180 to 200 millimoles of sodium per day. And none of them are adequately volume controlled. So they're volume expanded patients who have high aldosterone levels at a cross section. You can assume that they're already on an ACE or an ARB, that you're not adequately suppressing aldosterone.
You know, if Bert Pitt were here, Britt Pitt's a former chief of cardiology at University of Michigan, and he's beyond passionate with aldosterone blockade. To your question, I think he would say, and I'm paraphrasing, who cares? He's on dialysis. You know he's going to get heart failure. He's already got heart failure. We have overwhelming evidence this is going to help you. Who cares what his aldosterone is? He needs to be treated and forget about it. And that's the kind of approach that's being taken. The one thing I was going to say, do you have a question? Good.
Yes, I was waiting here. I wanted, you know, when you in your discussions about Aldo, you focus a lot on the cardiovascular effects. And I didn't hear very much about Aldo's effects on potassium balance, either acute versus chronic, and whether in your studies you're selecting out patients who are very good about staying on low potassium diets. I mean, will this, in California, our potassiums, I guarantee you, are higher than this.
Yeah.
And Aldo becomes way more important as your potassium intake increases. Even the colon component that you minimize becomes more important as the potassium goes higher. I mean, there are studies showing that ACE inhibitors will affect, will cause hyperkalemia in patients depending on their colon. If you know, so I just was curious about what in your studies. Is there a potential for bias from that standpoint about the potassium in the diet?
Well, I mean, I think every study has that inherent bias that you have people who are willing to participate in a study who are probably on the healthier spectrum of patients. That being said, you know, George's observational data from his resistant hypertensive clinic showed a 0.7 milliequivalent per liter rise in potassium. I think that's reasonable to expect. And one of the things that I think most nephrologists agree with is that our upper limit of potassium is different than LabCorp's or Quest's or even our local hospital labs. I don't get nervous with potassiums of 5.8, 5.9, especially in a dialysis patient.
Well, wait a minute. Before you get up, no, come on. But that statement makes me laugh because he hasn't seen this data. There's a database that we just analyzed. It's in review in Kidney International right now. And it's 800,000 patients. And it looks at people with stage 3 CKD, the general population, stage 3, and stage 4 CKD. It turns out that the higher your stage of CKD, where you may not care if your K is 5.3, if your normal kidney function, that 5.3 is associated with a 70% higher mortality rate in the CKD population. So this paper, I'm sure, is going to have an editorial, and it's going to really, I mean, we were all shocked when we saw the data. It's going to rechange our thinking about this.
I'll write the editorial.
Well, no, but I mean, even in Dr. Backus's data, he was dealing with potassium, so your starting point was 4.2, 4.4. My point is when their potassiums are starting at 5 or 5.5, the effect of Aldo, inhibiting Aldo, is going to be greater. And you can't compare those. They're like apples and oranges. You can't really compare those patients.
So I think, again, there's a difference between blocking aldosterone as an epithelial effect and blocking it as a non-epithelial effect. All the studies that I show are using very low doses. Usually the average dose for spironolactone in those studies is 25. For a eplerenone, it's 50. If you give those to a patient with normal renal function, those are non-diuretic doses. So they're not epithelial doses. They're really hormonal doses. They're meant not to target the ENaC channel. They're really meant to target these non-epithelial receptors where you're getting most of the fibrotic effect.
Andy, there's a paper that was published in 1979.
This is the danger of being on a panel with...
No, because they're obviously interested in this, so we need to help them. In 1979, there was a paper published by Ted Goodfriend, who's an endocrinologist at the University of Wisconsin. And it was not a study in man. It was a study done in cells, in kidney cells. But it actually suggested that torsemide, of all the loop diuretics actually had aldosterone inhibiting properties. I'm unaware of any proper clinical study that has looked at that, and I'm simply asking, is that true? The cardiologists love it because it's long acting and you don't have to mess around like Lasix and BID and TID. So I'm just wondering if there was any data.
I don't know.
Okay. I don't know. That's why I'm asking the question.
I don't know either.
Looks good. Thank you very much. Yeah,
thank you
to our great panel and our great audience. And you have a great evening in Miami.